Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the legendary Newport Jazz Festival in Rhode Island showcased a rising generation of artists this year. About a third of the festival's band leaders were around 30 years old or under. One of the great coming-of-age movies is the film Stand By Me. The movie just turned 25, and its star, Will Wheaton, remembers what it was like to make it. And an iconic folk art in India is disappearing, much to the delight of animal rights activists. Snake charmers are increasingly hard to find in major Indian cities, and the practice may be dying out. But first,
Esquire magazine once called George Pelecanos the poet laureate of the D.C. crime world. That's Washington, D.C., of course. Pelecanos has written 17 novels, all of them set in the nation's capital. He also wrote for the TV series The Wire, set in Baltimore, now writes for the New Orleans show Tremé, but the District of Columbia is home for him. And for our series Crime in the City, about crime novelists and their haunts, NPR's Elizabeth Blair cruised the streets of D.C. with the author. A note here to listeners, this story is going to contain some offensive language.
When George Pelecanos writes about crime in D.C., he's also writing about race and class. He says it all started when he was 11 years old. He was working at his dad's coffee shop downtown. To get there, he'd take the bus from his home in a Maryland suburb. It was the summer of 1968. Martin Luther King Jr. had recently been assassinated, and there'd been rioting in the streets.
I was on the bus going down 7th Street, which had just burned down two months earlier, and then, you know, seeing the people on the bus, they were acting differently than they had before. They were dressing much more boldly, and I remember the women wearing these big earrings, said black is beautiful on them, and they had silhouettes of women with afros. And then I'd get to work, and the counter was there, and my dad and I, Greek Americans, and an all-black crew on one side of the counter, and on the other side was white professionals, because it was 1968. And, you know, the counter was a dividing line. I knew it. And I've been writing about race and class my whole career. I mean, that's where it all comes from. It comes from that summer, pretty much.
D.C. was a powder keg back then, says Pelecanos, with the tension between the white police and the black residents. That's partly why he made one of his most important characters, Derek Strange, one of D.C.'s first black cops. In one scene, a black crowd gathers in front of a drugstore in a blighted part of the city. They're throwing rocks and bottles. Derek Strange and his white partner were called to the scene.
Strange and Troy joined the police line in front of the store and spread out several arm lengths, but remained side by side.
This is from the audiobook of the novel Hard Revolution.
From what Strange could see, he was the sole black officer on the scene. He heard screams of Tom and House Nigger and felt a pounding in his head. He brandished his stick and slapped it rhythmically into his palm. He did not look the crowd members in their eyes. Serve and protect. Do your job.
There were also white cops who didn't like blacks being hired. For his research, Pelecanos interviewed former D.C. police officers. One told him some white officers out and out quit.
They weren't going to work with black officers. These are guys that he said were, he didn't even know they were like that, but they just, when it started happening, they said, I'm done. You know, this isn't going to work for me.
The street crimes of a George Pelecanos novel can be brutal. And oftentimes, there's more than one unfolding in the same book. Neighborhood murders, drug lords, prostitutes, hate crimes. Even the good guys get ugly.
I'm not really interested in writing books about racists. I think much more interesting is people that don't think that they have any kind of those bad feelings inside of them, and they deny it.
Pelecanos makes all of them vivid. He tells you what car they drive and what music they listen to. With the greasers, it might be Springsteen or a rocker named Link Ray. With Detective Derek Strange, it's the soundtracks to westerns and classic soul.
Oh, I look like I'm down in my luck.
Derek Strange was a star athlete in high school. He's a leader in his community. Later, he coaches Pee Wee football. When he becomes a private investigator, he opens his office in the neighborhood where he grew up so that kids can see a strong black man going to work every day.
Yeah, I'm going to take you by his house.
Yeah. Okay. These row houses look like they've been around for a while.
Yeah, this is real old Washington here.
fictional Strange would have lived here when he was a boy with his mom and dad and brother. Families live here, but crime is high.
When I first started writing about this neighborhood, there was, you know, they would find dead bodies here in the morning. Kids would be walking to school and there'd be a dead body stashed here.
There are some strong parallels between real life and Pelicanos' fiction, says D.C. homicide detective Mitch Cradle.
All of our murders that we deal with are normally in the neighborhoods.
Detective Cradle has worked for D.C. police for 25 years. He says when Pelicanos writes the good guys and the bad guys in the same community, that's the real thing.
A lot of the criminal element is not necessarily from outside of those communities. For us as detectives, it's not hard for us to gather information in those communities because everyone knows who's committing them, opposed to being strangers. So I can see where George can really get a feel for what he's writing about, because any and everything he needs is right there.
George Pelicanos does the kind of shoe leather work of a detective when he's working on a novel, walking the streets, talking to people, studying the history of a neighborhood. As we drive through D.C. together, he points out landmarks that he includes in his books. For his new novel, The Cut, he picked out exactly which house his protagonist, Spiro Lucas, would rob.
Because I cased it. I went back in the alley and I looked to see if you could break into a place in the middle of the day. And, I mean, I can even show you the house. And so all these things...
Did you bring your tools, too?
The tools are in the trunk.
When George Pelicanos talks about what it was like growing up in D.C., he describes himself as a bit of a greaser. He once drove a jacked-up Camaro and liked to go to bars and drink whiskey. But he also worked as a dishwasher and sold women's shoes. It's no wonder Pelicanos can move so easily through the different worlds that make up D.C. He says he's liked getting to know two other cities, Baltimore when he wrote for The Wire, and now New Orleans writing for Tremé. But he says his novels will always take place in D.C. His life's work is right here. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You can delve into the D.C. that George Pelicanos writes about with photographs and readings at NPR.org. Our series Crime in the City resumes on Thursday with a cop's eye view of hard-boiled Seattle.
Boss Man Bob Cormier here. It's a beautiful Friday morning in Portland. It's 90 KLAM degrees and getting hotter.
We're going to take you back in time now to a hot summer in Oregon.
It's Boss.
The film Stand By Me told the story of four young boys.
Gun will travel, reads the card of a man. A knife without armor in a savage land.
They were 12 years old, their entire lives in front of them. Richard Dreyfuss narrated the movie as the voice of one of the boys, all grown up and remembering how important their childhood adventure was.
Everything was there and around us. We knew exactly who we were and exactly where we were going.
The four youngsters hiked into the wilderness searching for the dead body of another kid. What they saw, what they talked about, what they discovered about themselves all became the quintessential coming-of-age story, and it still is even today, 25 years later. The child actor at the center of that movie, the kid version of Richard Dreyfuss's character, was Will Wheaton, and he's with us in the studios of NPR West. Will, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
You know, it's kind of amazing. Stand By Me, the film, debuted 25 years ago Monday, and you were 12 years old.
Yeah, I actually turned 13 during production.
Wow. Well, you made a few other films before that, but this was the first time you were really in a lead, right? Was it scary?
No, I was too young to know that I should be afraid. I felt from the very first time we all got together up in Oregon that we were making something really special. And I don't know how much of that is just the naivete of being 12 and being an actor and being excited to be on location working on a feature, and how much of that was actually what we really felt when we were all together working on the film.
You start alongside River Phoenix, Jerry O'Connell, Corey Feldman. And to me, what makes the movie so great and memorable is really the chemistry that the four of you really shared on screen. And Where did that come from? I mean, was that a product of the relationships you had on the set?
I think that the casting in Stand By Me is one of the reasons the movie is such an incredible success. Rob Reiner found four young boys who basically were the characters we played. I was awkward and nerdy and shy and uncomfortable in my own skin and really, really sensitive. And River was cool and really smart and passionate and kind of, even at that age, kind of like a father figure to some of us. Jerry was one of the funniest people I had ever seen in my life before or since.
He's Vern, the bigger kid.
Right. And Corey was unbelievably angry and in an incredible amount of pain and had an absolutely terrible relationship with his parents.
The role of a father, and you said you have two kids of your own, really came into focus in the movie. Gordy, your character, had lost his brother, who was a football star, and Gordy was dealing with this fear that his dad wished it had been him who died.
Yeah, it's really clear Gordy's parents loved Denny, his older brother, and just didn't bother to really make a connection with Gordy.
Let's listen to a little of you talking about this from the movie.
Why do you have to die, Chris? Why did Denny have to die? Why? I don't know. Should have been me. Don't say that. My dad said it. I'm no good. He doesn't know you. He hates me. No. He just doesn't know you. He hates me. My dad
hates. Do you ever think about that as a dad now? Dealing with your own kids?
I'm crazy about my kids. My older son is home from college this summer, and we've spent the summer doing things together, and we're making our own beer together, and we went to Comic-Con together, and I have this incredible closeness to him. My younger son, you know, he's turning 20, and he's sort of like off kind of figuring himself out, and I don't have the same closeness with him that I have with his brother, just because he's kind of at a different place in his life. And I would never want to make my kids feel like I thought they were no good or that I, you know, loved one more than another or anything like that. But there's so much pain in that scene. And as a parent, I work to maintain relationships with my kids and respect kind of where they are in their lives and just be a good dad. And Rob told me that he wrote that scene and it had a lot to do with his relationship with his own father and that Gordy and Chris were sort of having this proxy discussion that Rob kind of needed to have. And he described sitting down in the hotel room in Oregon to write that scene and just sitting at his typewriter and sobbing as he wrote it.
I'm speaking with writer and actor Will Wheaton. He starred in the film Stand By Me, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. I just want to play one more scene from the film. This is when you and Chris Chambers are talking about your plans for school. And you're a smart kid. You're going to be going into the college courses.
Right, and he's going into woodshop.
He's going into woodshop, and you're trying to tell him that he should come with you.
Maybe you could go into the college courses with me. He won't let me. Just one of those low-life Chambers kids.
And we should say that it's actor River Phoenix who played your best friend in the movie,
Chris right.
Chambers. He died in 1993 of an overdose. Such a promising young actor at the time, and Stand By Me really launched his career. Talk about your relationship with him.
We were extremely close during production. I loved him. He was smart, and he was musically talented, and he was kind. He was one of the kindest people I'd ever been around. And as we stayed friends after we worked on the film, and I went and visited his family, and I guess around the time that I was turning maybe 15, we just drifted apart. And I always felt really sad about that. And when I saw Corey at the studio when we recorded the commentary for the Blu-ray, we talked about that, and he said, I went to see him over and over and over, because Corey had gotten sober. And he said, I went to see him over and over and over right before he died, and nobody could reach him. And then in the film, River Phoenix's character Chris dies. And there's this scene at the end of the movie where he fades away as Gordy's waving goodbye to him. And we sit there, you know, the three of us, Rob Reiner, Corey Feldman, and I are sitting there watching it. And
this was just recently. You were
just recently, yeah. And it was like all the air went out of the room. And we couldn't talk. And it's still something that fills me with a lot of conflicting emotions.
What should we take from all that? If we're trying to learn lessons from this movie and sort of its coming-of-age quality, and it does seem like there's this very eerie parallel between Chris Chambers, the character, and River Phoenix, the actor. I mean, how do you sort of deal with all this?
Stand By Me, it sort of talks about this time in your life that's feels incredibly complicated, but as you get older, you realize is actually incredibly simple. And we get the tremendous gift of not knowing that it's never going to be like that again for the rest of our lives. So it's just, it's pure and it's uncomplicated. And it's a time that stays with us even as we become adults. And I remember when my kids were the age that I was in Stand By Me. And I just thought, enjoy it, you guys.
You know, well, it's interesting. When we started talking about doing something around this anniversary, I thought we'd be talking about kind of an old movie that was in your past. But it really does seem to inspire, you know, emotion for you and a lot of people still today.
I'm really lucky. A lot of actors will spend their entire careers trying to find a film like Stand By Me. And I got to have it when I was a kid. And I get to stand on top of that for the rest of my life.
That's actor and writer Will Wheaton, an alum of Star Trek The Next Generation, and of course also of the film Stand By Me, which hit theaters 25 years ago on Monday. Will, thanks so much for being here with us.
It's my pleasure.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
What sound through yonder window breaks? Why, it's the latest entry in our series, Summer Sounds.
It's summertime.
My name is Larry Lanier, and I write about theater for the Oklahoma Gazette. Here's an oft-heard sound of summer, Shakespeare in the Park.
Here, lie I down and measure out my grave.
It's a mashup between Shakespeare and modern civilization. It was a pretty good sight gag the first time I saw actors on stage in Elizabethan costumes stop, look up, and marvel at a loud, low-flying jet plane.
I thank ye, and be blessed for your good comfort.
Thou seest, we are not all alone and happy.
Or the time a motorcycle convention roared by.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players.
And police helicopters chopper to and fro.
If that thou be found so near, I'll ring as 20 miles.
The actors always soldier on, suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and take up arms against a sea of troubles. 400 years of mechanical and technological advancements, and William's words still cut through the din.
Shall we be sundered? Shall we part, sweet girl? No, let my father seek another heir.
The Summer Sound of Shakespeare from Larry Lanier of Norman, Oklahoma. Snake charmers used to be a common sight at Indian markets and festivals, beguiling people with their ability to control some of the world's most venomous reptiles. But critics say it's a tradition based on cruelty and that it can't stop fast enough. NPR's Corey Flintoff hit the streets of New Delhi in search of a snake charmer.
It's not easy to find a snake charmer these days, even on Nag Panchami, the yearly religious festival in honor of the king cobra. It took a full day of searching to find Buddhanath, a thin brown man sitting cross-legged on the pavement behind a round, flat container, a bit like a tortilla basket. Buddhanath has a long white beard, a loosely wrapped orange turban, and a sweet, joyous expression as he taps the basket.
Shankar Bhagwan ke naam hai. Inki aaj bhi hamare yahan.
He's Lord Shiva's cobra, and we worship him, Buddhanath says. The blue-skinned Hindu god is usually portrayed wearing a king cobra around his neck. The charmer flips the lid off the basket, and the cobra pops up like a jack-in-the-box, scanning around with its hood fully extended. It fixes its gaze on the tip of Buddhanath's gourd flute. The cobra's black scales glisten as it sways, following the movement of the tip of the flute. It looks to be about 4 feet long, coiled in the basket, with a small, almost jewel-like head and glittering black eyes above the outstretched hood. For a couple of minutes, the man and the snake seem connected in a very ancient, intricate dance. But the snake can't hear a thing.
Snakes don't have ears. Most people don't know that.
This is Kartik Satyanarayan, a co-founder of the animal rescue group Wildlife SOS.
But snake charmers use the pipe. So what the snake sees is simply something which is menacing above him, which is swaying. So the snake's attention is focused on the swaying object and moves along with that. So it appears to people that the snake is actually dancing to the tune of his pipe.
Satyanarayan says the illusion of the poisonous snake tamed and charmed by music is often based on very cruel practices. In order to prevent the snake from biting, snake charmers sometimes break off the animal's fangs or sew its mouth shut. The result is that the snake can't eat and slowly starves to death. Buddhanath insists that he has done nothing of the kind. He says the snake has merely been tamed and won't bite. He also says that he's about to release the snake back into the wild because he can only keep it for 6 months. A 1972 law forbids anyone from keeping a snake, but it hasn't been enforced much in the case of snake charmers until recently. The Indian government has tried to accommodate traditional snake charmers while trying to keep them from capturing more snakes. The government implanted identification chips under the skin of some snakes that were already in captivity so that it can scan the animals and confiscate any that are newly captured and have no chips. Satyanarayan says his group is trying to rehabilitate snake charmers by turning them into snake rescuers, the people who are called to remove venomous snakes from city and suburban gardens and restore them to the wild.
So today, instead of catching a snake and using it, exploiting it, killing it, they actually help us protect snakes.
And he says, it's not just the law that's working against the snake charmers as performers. People in India are now more attuned to television shows and video games than they are to street performers of any kind. Still, if it were possible to save something from the art of snake charming, it might be this. That seductive little song that snakes can never hear. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, New Delhi.
The 57th Newport Jazz Festival concludes tonight with a performance by 25-year-old New Orleans native Trombone Shorty. About a third of the artists featured at this year's festival are around age 30 or younger. Lara Pellegrinelli sent this snapshot of Newport's newest generation of jazz lovers.
The new Black Eagle Jazz Band is about as traditional as they come. The musicians have been playing together for 40 years, and they open this year's Newport Jazz Festival with rousing old-time New Orleans music, a style that dates back to the teens and the 1920s. At the same moment, a mere 300 feet away on another stage at Fort Adams is a band of 30-somethings on the opposite end of the musical spectrum. It's called Mostly Other People Do the Killing. The musicians take their musical cues from pop, rock, experimental music, and punk, although their dark suits and sunglasses suggest ironic new wave. Their wild, brash humor makes you think they might be thumbing their noses at traditional jazz.
No, not even a little bit.
Bassist Moppa Elliott was greeting his parents, jazz-loving parents, who brought him to the Newport Festival starting when he was too young to even remember.
Yeah, these are my folks.
He and trumpeter Peter Evans figured out that they'd both heard Miles Davis at the same Newport Fest back when they were in elementary school. Even though Elliott was a child of the 80s, he was brought up on a different soundtrack. Classic jazz albums of the 1950s on labels like Blue Note, Prestige, and Impulse.
And so I kind of grew up surrounded by this kind of music, and it's just, you know, the core of what I hear in my head when I hear things that aren't voices.
You might be tempted to label music like Elliott's crossover. The term was invented by marketing executives in the early 1990s, who equated self-conscious genre bending with chart-crossing hits, if they were lucky. Today, musicians seem more interested in transforming traditional styles to reach audiences of their peers. Newport's artistic co-director, Jason O'Lane, says that's what he's seen.
Musicians are, their nature is to create and interpret music as they see it and what makes sense to them, and it's in a personal way. And growing up with, in the world of backbeat is probably going to have some sort of influence versus growing up in the world of swinging jazz from the 50s and 60s.
There are no headliners at this year's Newport Festival, no interloping pop or R&B artists. There were huge crowds for Esperanza Spalding, the bassist and singer who won this year's Grammy for Best New Artist. She tours with veteran saxophonist Joe Lovano and veteran rocker Prince. Trombone Shorty, another musician who brings different contemporary influences to jazz, actually got audiences up off their feet and dancing in their clam diggers during his set Saturday afternoon. There may be some naysayers, but the new Black Eagle Jazz Band's clarinetist, Billy Novick, has nothing but praise for the younger generation.
Love it. Some of the people who play this music are stodgy about it and very kind of judgmental about other kinds of music. We're not that way.
And neither, it would seem, are most of the people in the lawn chairs of Newport. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in Newport, Rhode Island.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.